Thank you. So to start off, why do we care about the black hole mass function? What does the black hole mass function give us? And well, the black hole mass function is essentially the number density, the co-moving number density of supermassive black holes and given mass spin. And so in this sense, it's really one of the most fundamental empirical quantities that we can go ahead and try to derive or estimate. That allows us to place some constraints and probes on the buildup of the black hole population as a function of redshift, the duty cycle of supermassive black hole activity. Duty cycle is defined as a fraction of time any given black hole might be on or off. And as we heard earlier, for example, with Priya's talk, it also placed some constraints on black hole seeding models, especially the high redshift black hole mass function. In addition, when combined with the luminosity function, the black hole mass function gives us a handle on the Eddington ratio distribution as well. And if we have the Eddington ratio distribution as a function of, say, mass, then we can start to go ahead and place some constraints or try to learn some things about typical growth times of supermassive black holes and the rate at which they're growing. And finally, the black hole mass function is also useful as a survey planning tool because it allows us to understand or try to estimate what mass and Eddington ratio range any planned survey may probe and to see if that's going to give us answer the science questions that we're interested in. All right, so there are generally two different ways that people estimate the black hole mass function. Now, it's important to remember that we can't actually measure mass for a large number of supermassive black holes, and so we have to resort to different ways of deriving the mass function through modeling the data that we actually can observe. And one of these ways is to use scaling relationships to try to connect the black hole mass function to some set of observable quantity based on a scaling relationship that provides the link between these two quantities. So, for example, you may use, say, the stellar velocity dispersion for a galaxy as a proxy for the mass, and then use the distribution of velocity dispersions in connection with the M-sigma relationship to then see what set of mass functions are consistent with this. And that allows you a way to go ahead and get at the mass function using the type of techniques. Now, generally, beyond the local universe, primary scaling relationship that people use is scaling relationships between the broad emission line widths and the continuum luminosity for type 1 quasars and the black hole mass. And so people have used these broad line mass estimates at higher redshift to try to get at the mass function for these particular type of objects, type 1 quasars. The other approach that people have used to get at the mass function is through continuity equation techniques. And so the basic idea behind these techniques is to go ahead and use the AGN luminosity function as a constraint on how fast the black hole mass function is changing. This is because the luminosity function is probing how fast the black holes are growing in the different and various mass spins as a function of redshift, and so it's giving you a handle on how fast the mass function is changing. Then when you combine that with the local mass function, you can go ahead and work backwards in time so and to derive the mass function for all supermassive black holes as a function of redshift. Andrea Merloni mentioned some of this work earlier in his talk. And this has the advantage that it allows you to get at the mass function for all supermassive black holes, at least in principle, but it also requires a little bit more additional assumptions and modeling on its end as compared to the scaling relationship type of techniques. And in this talk, I'm going to be talking about the work that I've done, which is primarily devoted to using scaling relationships for the type 1 quasars. So I've been primarily working with Sloan data, DR3 and earlier work, and DR7 more recently. And in our most recent work that I've done in collaboration with Yushen, we use the Sloan DR7 quasar catalog. So this has about 58,000 quasars between redshifts at 0.3 and 5. And we use these broad line scaling relationships to derive the mass function. The nice thing about this data set, in addition to its size, is that it's uniformly selected with a well-established selection function that's reported in Gordon Richard's work. So this is very important if we want to go ahead and try to do our best in completeness correction that we're able to for this data set. We use H-beta where we can at lower redshifts, and then intermediate redshifts, we used magnesium 2, and then carbon 4 at the highest redshifts. In addition, we also use the Bayesian technique that I developed a few years ago to correct for the incompleteness and statistical uncertainty in the mass estimates. So the mass estimates derived from the scaling relationships have an estimated statistical scatter of about 0.4 decs or so. You can kind of think of this as a measurement error, in a sense, on the mass estimate that's fundamentally ingrained in the actual scaling relationship itself, so there's no way to really improve upon that. That has the effect of broadening the inferred mass function if you just go ahead and treat the mass estimates as they are. The other issue is incompleteness. At any given mass, you have a broad range of luminosities, and so this creates a different incompleteness type of correction that you would need to employ beyond just the standard methods people use in luminosity function estimation. So we've been developed some Bayesian techniques to go ahead and account for both of those effects, and that's what we use when deriving the mass functions. So this shows the type 1 quasar black hole mass function that we get. Blue is the mass function. Orange is the binned estimate of the mass function. So this is what happens if you just bin up the mass estimates. You can see the two diverge, especially at lower masses where incompleteness starts to affect the binned mass function. And the vertical line in each panel shows the 10% completeness limit in mass. So to the left of that line, Sloan is more than 90% incomplete in mass. And so you're only getting less than 10% of quasars below that mass line. So I wouldn't I'd be very skeptical about any features that fall to the left of that. So one of the things you notice for mass functions is that there's no obvious sign for a turnover in the mass distribution down to the incompleteness limit. In addition, Sloan is also highly incomplete. It's a very shallow survey in mass, and so we really have a tough time. Sloan has a tough time finding quasars that are at masses less than 5 × 10⁸ to 10⁹ solar masses or so. And to go ahead and put that in terms of the n-sigma relationship, that's the mass range that we're probing with Sloan. So the objects that we're looking at in the Sloan survey that black holes that live in Sloan quasars, higher redshift, end up living locally in this high mass tail, the sigma diagram, in early type galaxies. This is the black hole addition ratio function. So the color scheme is the same as before. Again, for most redshift bins, we don't see any obvious evidence for a turnover in addition ratio. Black holes live in type 1 quasars, have a broad range of Eddington ratios. Most of them are not radiating near the Eddington limit, but at more modest Eddington ratio levels. The only possible evidence for turnover is in these high redshift bins. It's unclear if that's a systematic effect or not at this point. But you can see that there's a broad range of Eddington ratios that black holes radiate at. And so there are various things that we can do with this, compare with theoretical models, go ahead and look for things like downsizing and stuff. I don't have time to get through everything that we did. So I'm just going to talk about this very simple approach that we did to try to get a handle on typical growth times for quasars. So we can go ahead and say, well, we have in a given mass bin, at least at the high mass end where we feel like we're relatively complete, an estimate of the average Eddington ratio. So we can go ahead and use this to say, well, what's the typical growth time for black holes if we make some simple assumptions such that on average over time it was radiating at this Eddington ratio, it has a radiative efficiency of, say, 10%, and it had a seed mass of 1 million solar masses, which kind of falls near the upper envelope of the theoretical predictions. And so based on that, we can go ahead and say, well, how long would it have taken to grow a supermassive black hole from 1 million solar masses to, say, 10⁹ solar masses, if it was on average radiating at the Eddington ratio that we see the average value for this population. And that's what's plotted over here on the right. And so counterclockwise from the top left, the mass bins are 5 × 10⁸, 10⁹, 5 × 10⁹, and then 10⁰. Now in each of these plots, the red error bars correspond to redshift bins where we use carbon-4, the blue magnesium-2, and the green H-beta. The solid line shows the age of the universe as a function of redshift, and the dashed line shows the growth time for Eddington limited accretion, so if they were radiating at the Eddington limit. You can see that in pretty much all mass bins, down to about redshift of 2 or so, the growth time scales that we infer are comparable to or longer than the age of the universe, suggesting that these black holes would have had to been growing faster before we ended up seeing them. So they would have had to, on average, been at higher Eddington ratios earlier than the time that we saw them. So they would have had accelerated growth in the past, possibly during an obscured phase. That's why we don't see them. Maybe it's just that at the lower masses, the Eddington ratios are also higher, so they're growing faster, and we wouldn't have seen them because of these lower masses. They wouldn't have made it into our survey. It's difficult to distinguish between those two type of things, but it does suggest that in a lot of ways, I think that the more typical objects that for the population beyond just the extreme high redshift quasars that are already radiating almost near the Eddington limit and very massive, yes, it's hard to go ahead and grow those, but it's going to be even harder, I think, to grow the more typical average low Eddington rate massive black holes that are really just below our completeness limit or at the edge of it. So in the last couple minutes that I have, I'm going to be talking about some of the recent work that I've been doing investigating alternative methods for estimating black hole mass, in my case based on X-ray variability. And I think one of the things that, one of the motivating reasons for doing this is because of unknown systematic effects in various scaling relationships, mass estimates derived from scaling relationships. And so I've shown a lot of hopefully interesting results on what you can get from mass functions derived from scaling relationships, but it's only for one type of scaling relationship, the Brownian mass estimates. And so to increase the robustness of these type of results regarding aging and demographics with black hole mass to net ratio, it's helpful to have multiple different scaling relationships so we can go ahead and do the same thing and see what results stick and which ones start to go ahead and diverge, if any. And so there's a couple potential systematic effects we need to worry about with single epoch mass estimates for based on the broad emission lines. One, I think Mayanna is going to talk about this, some of these later in her talk as well, is that at low signal to noise, it's difficult to measure the full width half max. You can get a bias there, and that can create a bias in your mass estimate. There's also the scatter in mass estimates at high redshift, high luminous Sloan quasars is smaller than you would expect based on the quoted statistical uncertainty in these mass estimates, which is basically defined as a scatter about the local reverberation mapping calibration sample. And so that's a little disconcerting as well. It's weird. Why is that happening? What does that mean? And then, of course, we also worry about extrapolating beyond the calibration sample. So an idea that's kind of been tossed around in the X-ray community for about a decade now is the possibility of using X-ray variability to estimate black hole mass. And the advantage of having this additional mass estimator, like I just said, is it balances out possibly unknown systematic effects. And the X-ray variability in particular is a nice clean measurement in principle that you don't have different nuisance components that you need to go ahead and take out, like line deblending, a host galaxy component, and so on. It's relatively clean AGN emission. Now, to illustrate this, I'm quickly going to show the typical power spectra, X-ray power spectra, which is shown over here on the left for AGN. You have this high frequency part of the power spectrum, which decreases with black hole mass, the amplitude of it. So this is basically saying that the amplitude of high frequency variability is larger for smaller mass black holes. And so if you can measure this, you can go ahead and use this if the scatter is small enough as a black hole mass estimator, as a proxy for mass. And there's a whole decade's worth of work doing this type of stuff, and I don't have time to go into the details of this. But this shows the high frequency variability amplitude on the y-axis function of black hole mass from a recent work using techniques that I developed to go ahead and derive this directly from time irregularly spaced time series. So it improves over some of the other issues. But it implies you can get mass estimates between 0.3 and 0.38 dex scatter or so. All right, so my summary, I'm out of time. Let's quickly go through this. SDSS is very incomplete, below 5 times 10 to the 8 and a tenth of Eddington. There is no evidence for a turnover in black hole mass Eddington ratio distributions, and the growth time scales that we infer from our mass functions and Eddington ratio functions suggest that there was an earlier stage of accelerated, possibly obscured growth. And I didn't have time to go ahead and say this, but the X-ray variability could, in principle, I think, be used to drive mass functions for a several epoch X-ray survey, in the sense that you don't need a really well-sampled long light curve to go ahead and get constraints on the ensemble variability. You just need a lot of light curves that have smaller cadencing, and then you can try to say something about the mass function if you don't care about what the masses are for individual sources, but you only care about the population. Right, thank you.
Questions?
So you showed. All right. So you showed the growth time scales of. Could you bring the plot back? So that's. Those growth time scales of different quasars are directly dependent on the black hole mass and the bolometric luminosities, right, which you scale from some optical UV luminosity, right?
Right. We use a constant bolometric correction. So strictly speaking, the Eddington ratio is optical luminosity divided by black hole mass.
Right. So if the black hole mass is maybe slightly overestimated, which is actually, I'm going to talk about that later this afternoon, that would bring the growth time scales down a little bit, right? So some of these high redshifts ones that appear to be growing at scale time scales that are very much longer than the age of the universe at that time could potentially come down closer to the Eddington.
Yeah, you mean if the masses are smaller than we're actually,
Okay, I just thought I'd point that out.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for factors of two-ish slop kind of in this, but I think even if you get these down below the age of the universe, you're still kind of right at that point. So I still think it creates some pressure on the CD models.
Thanks. This is my question is on the same figure, so it's good here. So here you're assuming that these black holes have been accreting in the past at the same accretion rate that you're seeing. But Ellison and Andrea both showed that the distribution of specific accretion rates increases in normalization with time. So what if the accretion rates were higher in the past? By how much? I mean, you cannot go much below the Eddington curve, I guess. But by how much going from the value that you have now to the Eddington rate would you gain? I mean, is it an easy gain or is it a large switch?
I think if it really depends on how long they would have been growing, weighted by how fast. So if they were at higher Eddington ratios, for example, but on at a higher Eddington ratio for a shorter period of time, and then what we see them at for a longer period of time, or moderately higher for most of the time, and then recently switched off, you could go ahead, it would depend on that. But I think if kind of the time averaged Eddington ratio was, I guess it looks like a factor of five or so.
Five, okay.
Higher, then you could accommodate them within the age of the universe. But, you know, it's still not that much time.
Very quick question. And you said this creates tension with seed models. Are you implying that seeds should be much more massive, like 10 to the 8 solar masses or so? So what can you clarify what you mean exactly by tension with seed models? Many more black holes, much more massive ones?
Not necessarily tension with seed models. What I'm saying is I think the easiest way out of this, I guess, is that you have accelerated growth before we saw them as type 1 quasars. And then you don't have problems with the CD models and so on. But if you say that the growth was not accelerated earlier, so they were not at higher Eddington ratios before we see them, then you're going to have problems. And if it's like, well, you have a factor of five here in bolometric correction, and so yeah, if you can get it down to below the age of the universe and maybe get out of this, but even then you're just barely, I think, doing that.
So Marta, just to stress, because we've been doing these kind of calculations too, very consistent with what Brandon is showing. The assumption here, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you have 100% duty cycle at the observed rate. So I think there is a factor of 10 hiding there, something like that. And the Eddington ratio, how much higher could it be, right? So. Right, so and again, commenting on what Brandon just said about tension with seeding models, you can't have them accreting all the time till redshift of 2 at whatever Eddington ratio you
have. No, but this is exactly my point as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My point is somehow black holes have to form and have to grow to match the observations that we have. I mean, it's just that what are the options around to make sure that what we theorize makes sense based on these observations and the high redshift quasars, because we know that this is there. But on the other hand, it's very hard, theoretically, to think of forming out of nothing a 10 to a 9 solar mass black hole. I mean, nothing. I mean, starting from gas rather than another black hole.
Yeah, Any other questions? Okay, there are no more questions. We can thank Brendan. And we move on to the second speaker, is Daniel Angles Alcazar. And the title of his talk is Black Hole Growth in Galaxies Self-Regulated